Well, as they say in the trade, follow that. Wasn't William Boyd brilliant, but I had it in mind that he would be brilliant and that we therefore had this obligation to follow it with something equally brilliant. And if you've looked at what we've got in front of you, you realise that something brilliant is about to happen. So let me introduce our speaker. Maria, I've never actually asked if it's Janie?
Jani, it's a Polish name.
Jani, Maria Jani, thank you. I wouldn't have wanted to get it wrong. Maria did actually provide me with her own write-up. Some I made up myself because I couldn't be bothered getting in touch with people, but some were done by the people themselves. So I can do no better than introducing Maria by reading what she says about herself. Maria is a German theatre actress. After years on stage, she focused on dubbing, where she's now responsible for the realisation of the German version of foreign films. She's translating the scripts and directing the voice actors. Her passion for literature led her to Graham Greene. She translated the stage adaptation of Our Man in Havana into German and wrote an adaptation of Dr. Fischer of Geneva. So, Maria Jani.
Jani? Jani. Well, thank you, Mike, and good afternoon to everyone. I almost feel a bit intimidated by all the academic brightness around me. And hope you will forgive me my lack of academic virtuosity, at least in English language. In German it might be a bit better, but well, what's the point of that? I think it wouldn't be very entertaining for you. So, you just have to go with my emotional and passionate approach to Graham Greene. And I'm very honored to have been invited here to be speaking to you today about how I started to become a passionate agent, I would call it that way, for Graham Greene in German language. In 2017, I was playing Agatha Christie's Mousetrap at a Berlin theater when I was suddenly involved with the MI6. I had been performing that part 543 times. That's true. Not quite as often as they had done it at St. Martin's. I don't know, I forgot the number, but it's in the thousands. But it was often enough, I can tell you, often enough to get distracted while playing. And I got distracted by observing the audience, something an actor should never do, but, well, it happens. You sometimes even think about, well, your dinner and do the most dramatic parts. Happens. As long as the audience does not realize, it's fine. And in this case, I got distracted by somebody in the audience, and I would say, to me, it was James Bond personally. Yes, at least that's the impression I got from the intense energy that hit me, struck me from the direction a tall and elegant-looking man was seated. While having a very dramatic argument with my husband on stage, I imagined being a German double agent in World War II, and my fantasy took me to England, where I was meeting that mysterious agent I could see in front of me, going through the most dangerous adventures, escaping death, and, of course, falling in love. Well, this mysterious spectator I had seen there sent a luxurious box with dates to my dressing room and a note. We then met a bit later in a bar where he told me that indeed one of his ancestors had been involved with the MI6. That evening, I fell in love not only with Graham Greene's grandson, but also with Graham Greene himself, whom I had hardly known before. It is a mysterious fact that once you mention the name, people in Germany go, "Yes, of course, I do know Graham Greene." But actually, they haven't read any of his books. I personally made no exception. Even my father, who used to be an English teacher and spent, I don't know, 10 years in London being responsible of, forgive me, I forgot the name of the institute, but something very important, even him. Graham Greene, no idea. Embarrassing. So I started reading, and I couldn't stop. Never, and that's really true, never literature had caught me in such a personal way. I wouldn't even know how to describe what made his book so almost intimate to me. I suppose most of you will agree, or I've heard it at least, that that happens to many of his readers, that, there's something about it that is very personal in a way. As if, that's how it was to me, as if he was picking thoughts, feelings, views I had from some unconscious place in my mind, or maybe soul, and would present them to me on a plate with a little smile and a little spice, but never too much, always subtle. Well, you see, I become even poetically inspired by reading his books, and we'd rather want to avoid that, right? So indeed, I found a way to avoid it and thought of something useful. I thought of bringing Graham Greene to Germany. Why not to our English literature classes? Why not to German theaters? And that was quite obviously the very first approach I could dare to take without being too presumptuous, because at theater I felt at home. So I started with the idea of adapting The Third Man for stage. My romantic Mr. Bond and I traveled to London and to Paris to learn a lot about the complications of copyrights and rights, especially with The Third Man. This is very complicated. Nobody actually knows to whom the rights belong. And also about the fact that there was a musical planned in Vienna. It had been planned for since 2011, as far as I could find out, without ever premiering, but nevertheless, the rights were gone to singing Austrian dancers in the sewers. So I had to find something else. There were, and there are, existing stage adaptations, so why not translate them into German? I did a translation of Clive Francis's adaptation of Our Man in Havana. Some of you may have seen it. It's written for 4 actors, and it's quite nicely done, I would say. And working together with a German publishing company, I tried to meet the right tone. And this really is the thing. The German language is by far less subtle, in the sense that it usually leaves no room for interpretation. I certainly would rather want to be an English or French diplomat than a German one. It is like German engineering. A screw is a screw and has just one exact function. And so are the words. We have the fitting noun for everything, or otherwise we make it up by cueing as many of them as necessary. You all may have heard of words like Frauenfußball-Weltmeisterschafts-Endrunden-Teilnehmerinnen. I won't ask you to repeat the word. Especially since football, after this summer, may be a sensitive topic for the English, at least for some among you. Anyway, this was about German football, so there might be hope. Meeting Graham Greene's voice in German language was a challenge. I argued with a publisher about expressions like "don't be difficult," which would translate into "machen Sie keine Schwierigkeiten," but this sounds way too sober for the rather eccentric and mysterious character of Hawthorne. So I insisted on "seien Sie nicht schwierig," for those amongst you who understand German. You may know that this is not the correct term, it's not wrong grammatically, but you wouldn't use it that way. But it makes a slight difference in tone, just because it's not so common and rather unusual. And I thought that was a better match for that Hawthorne character who didn't enter the room like a German, let's say, insurance agent, but like an MI6 agent. I think that's a difference. Or there was the part of Millie, Wormald's daughter, who was said to pray the Hail Mary quite contrary, where Green, as far as I know, is referring to the nursery rhyme, Mary, Mary, quite contrary. And as I understand it, Millie, by using it, was provoking the nuns. The meaning of the lyrics is controversially discussed. It could be religious allegory of Catholicism, as well as it could be connected to Mary of Scotland or Mary First of England, then telling a story of an unfaithful husband, torture, executions, and miscarriages. So, how to find a solution in German? Hail Mary would be Gegrüßet seist du Maria in German, but there is no nursery rhyme to match the double meaning. The German translation of the novel wasn't very helpful because the translator just decided to have her pray Gegrüßet seist du Maria heißt du, which is not the official text of the prayer, but just means hail you, your name is Mary. So no provocative meaning about that, right? Anyway, by the way, the existing German translations of the books could generally do with a makeover. Many of them have a very Bavarian 1950s sound that reminds of, I would call it German couch cushions, who doesn't allow you to dive into this special Graham Greene tone. So that's really something I would... The more books I read, the more disappointed I got with the German translations. Anyway, at the end, I decided for Millie to pray Gegrüßet seist du Maria upside down to meet the meaning. Yeah, it would be a bit complicated and maybe rather boring for you to go further into details because I can't expect you to understand that much German. And I'm just left to happily announce that the play will have its German premiere at Badische Landesbühne on the 18th of November this year. Yeah. My next Graham Greene project was then the adaptation of Dr. Fischer of Geneva, a story that had its origin at the Bourget family's Christmas table when Graham visited his daughter and grandsons. I started here with an English version, which later can be translated into German. With the approval of Graham Greene Productions in London, I'm now looking for English theaters to produce it. So in case any one of you know a director, a theater, or somebody who might be interested, I'd be very grateful for your support and help, because clearly from Berlin, it's not so easy to make contacts. And to give you an impression of this adaptation, I proudly want to present you a little scene from that play, and that is the scene famously known as the porridge party. I found talented volunteers here amongst you to participate in that short scenic reading, and they even missed their lunch for a rehearsal. And I'm sure it was totally worth it. So I assume everybody is familiar with the plot. Or if not, do you need a short summary? Anybody? I doubt it. Huh? So then, otherwise, let me introduce you to Dr. Fischer's house, where they are waiting the so-called toads, who are his avid and greedy, albeit immensely rich, objects of charity, for the beginning of an exclusive dinner. We are at Dr. Fischer's. Now, just have your imagination working. The table is laid with crystal glasses and expensive soup plates. Mrs. Montgomery, Mr. Kipps, Monsieur Belmont, Dr. Fischer himself, and Mr. Dean in dinner jackets or evening gown are standing around. Now, as you can see, someone is missing. We didn't find a volunteer to act as Mr. Dean, so I'm asking the audience if someone would volunteer. I can promise it doesn't mean any word acting, just being an alcoholic former movie star sitting at the table and smile at a certain point in time. Then you are more than welcome to join us. So, The stage is still dark, just their silhouettes can be seen, Jones and Albert off stage.
What name?
Jones.
Dr. Fisher's engaged.
He's expecting me.
Dr. Fisher's dining with friends.
I happen to be dining with him myself.
Albert entering stage, the lights turn on.
Mr. Jones.
Jones entering stage, he's wearing a black suit. The toads are staring at him with hostility.
Come in, Jones. Albert, you can serve dinner as soon as it's ready. This is Jones, my son-in-law. You must excuse his glove, it hides a... Mrs. Montgomery? Mr. Kipps?
Monsieur Belmont? Mr. D?
Jones is a great linguist. He translates letters about chocolates. Here, Jones, at our little parties, we use English as our common language, because Dean, great star as he may be, speaks well. Though sometimes he does attempt some kind of French in his cups, usually after the third. On the screen, you've only heard him dubbed in French.
All the toads are laughing as though on cue. Except Dean, who gives a mirthless smile.
He has the quality after a drink or two to play Falstaff, except a lack of humor and a lack of weight. The second, tonight, we shall attempt to remedy. The humor, I'm afraid, is beyond us. You may ask what is left. Only his fast diminishing reputation amongst women and teenagers. Kipps, you're not enjoying yourself, are you? Something wrong?
Perhaps you miss our little aperitif.
But tonight, I did not want to spoil your palate for what is coming.
No, I assure you, nothing is wrong, Dr. Fisher, nothing.
I always insist at my little parties that everybody have fun.
Dr. Fisher is invariably a very good host, and so generous. This necklace I'm wearing, it was a prize at our last party. There's always a little prize for everyone.
Mrs. Montgomery is pointing to a pile of gift-wrapped parcels.
There the prizes are. I helped him choose.
Prizes for what?
Well, certainly not for intelligence, otherwise nobody would ever win anything.
Everyone is watching the pile of gifts.
All we have to do is just put up with his little whims, and then he distributes the prizes. There was one in... Can you believe it? He served up live lobsters with bowls of boiling water. We had to catch and cork our own. One lobster nipped the general's finger. He still bears the scar.
That was most probably the only wound he suffered in action.
It was a riot.
Anyway, that turned her hair blue. Before that night, it was an unsavory gray. Stained with nicotine.
Not grey. A natural blonde, and not nicotine stained.
Now, remember the rules, Mrs. Montgomery. If you contradict me once more, you will lose your prize.
Oh.
That happened once at one of our parties to Mr. Kipps. He lost an 18-carat... gold lighter, like this one.
He takes a leather case from his pocket.
It was little loss to me. I don't smoke.
Be careful, Kipps. Be careful. Don't denigrate my gifts, or yours might disappear a second time.
The toads are laughing as though on cue again. A bit uncertain this time.
Perhaps before we begin our dinner, a dinner I very much hope you'll enjoy and do full service to, as I put a lot of thought into it, I should explain to our new guest the etiquette we observe at our dinners.
Yes, most necessary. I think, if you will excuse me, you should perhaps have put his appearance here, shall we say, to the vote? After all, we are a kind of club.
I agree with Belmont. We all of us know where we stand. We accept certain conditions. It's all in the spirit of fun. A stranger might misunderstand.
When in fact, I know you are all afraid that the value of those prizes would diminish with a new guest, just like you thought it would rise after the death of two of our number.
A short silence.
You misunderstand me.
Albert enters, carrying a silver tray on which there is a large pot of caviar and little silver dishes of egg and onion and sliced lemons.
Now, you will excuse Albert for serving me first.
Oh, I adore caviar. Ah, I could live on it.
Of course you could afford to live on it if you were prepared to spend your own money.
I'm not such a rich woman as all that.
Oh, why bother lie to me? If you weren't as rich as you are, you wouldn't be sitting here. I only invite the richest.
What about Mr. Jones?
Well, that's not quite the same. You see, he is here an observer rather than a guest. Oh. But of course he is my son-in-law. He may imagine he has great expectations, perhaps. Expectations, too, are a form of wealth, do you know? Albert, the bibs.
Albert is fastening a bib round Mrs. Montgomery's neck.
Écrevisse! Oh, I love écrevisse!
And here's your dinner, so I can begin my own.
Albert is serving cold porridge.
Why? This is porridge. Cold porridge.
Real Scotch porridge. You should appreciate it with your Scottish name. Oh.
Dr. Fisher helps himself to caviar and vodka.
Don't be afraid of that. There's nothing to follow.
This is going too far, Dr. Fisher. Cold porridge, why? It's totally inedible.
Well, don't eat it then. Oh. Don't eat it, Mrs. Montgomery. By the rules, you will only lose your little present. I tell you the truth, I ordered porridge especially for Jones here. I had thought of some partridges, but how could he possibly manage with just one hand?
Kipps picks up his spoon.
If we could have a little sugar, it might help.
I understand the Welsh. I remember, Jones. I mean, the Scots consider it a blasphemy to spoil the porridge with sugar. They even eat it, I'm told, with salt. You may certainly have salt. Well, okay. Offer the gentleman salt, Albert. Mrs. Montgomery apparently has decided to go hungry.
Oh, no. No, I won't ruin your little joke, Dr. Fisher. Give me the salt. It can't make the porridge any worse than it is.
Everybody except for Jones is eating in silence and with a grim intensity.
You don't attempt yours, Jones.
I'm not hungry enough.
Not rich enough. For several years now, I've been studying the greediness of the rich. They'll do nothing. They'll do anything, actually, to get their presents for nothing. This is one of the hardest tests I've submitted these to yet. But look how quickly they're eating up the porridge. Tja, I'm afraid if you don't eat it, you won't get anything.
I have something of more value than your presents waiting for me at home.
Yes, very gallantly put. But don't be too confident. Women don't always wait. And then I doubt if a missing hand aids romance. Albert, seems Mr. Dean is ready for second.
Oh, no, not second helping.
Albert, another plate for Mr. Kipps. And I see Mrs. Montgomery is nearly ready. Hurry up, Belmont, hurry up. You know, no presents before everyone is finished. Watch them, Jones. They're so anxious to be finished, they even forget to drink.
I don't suppose Ivornia goes well with porridge.
Have a good laugh of it at them, Jones. Come on, they won't take it amiss.
I don't find them funny.
Aren't you reminded a bit of, pigs eating out of a trough? Mr. Kipps has spilt some porridge down his shirt. Oh, clean him up, Albert, will you?
You revolt me, Dr. Fisher.
Yes, I can understand how you feel, of course. I sometimes feel that way myself. But my research must go to its end. Oh, bravo, Kipps. You're catching them up. You ply a good spoon.
Why do you do it?
Why should I tell you? After all, perhaps I should. But you are not one of us, and you never will. Don't count on your expectations of me.
I don't.
You have a poor man's pride, I see. After all, why shouldn't I tell you about this? You're a sort of son, I suppose. I want to discover, Jones, if the greed of our rich friends has any limit. If there is a thus far no further. The greed certainly isn't limited by pride. Mr. Kipps here, like Herr Krupp, would have sat down happily to eat with Hitler in expectation of favors, whatever was placed before him. I think tonight marks the end of one experiment. I'm playing with another idea.
You are a rich man yourself. Are there limits to your greed?
Perhaps I shall find out one day. But my grief is of a different kind. I'm not greedy for trinkets, Jones.
Trinkets are harmless enough.
I like to think that my greed is little more like God's.
Is God greedy?
Mrs. Montgomery has finished her porridge, Albert. You can take her plate. The believers and the sentimentalists say that God is greedy for our love. I prefer to think that, judging from the world he is supposed to have made, he can only be greedy for our humiliation. And that greed, how could he ever exhaust? It's bottomless.
Yes, thank you so much for your commitment, all of you. We didn't have much time, just two short rehearsals, but maybe it gave you an impression and maybe you'd like to support it. As you could hear, it is very, or maybe it wasn't obvious, but it is very close to the original. I actually did what the two gentlemen yesterday said wouldn't be possible. I stuck to the spoken word in Graham Greene's novel, and I thought it works very well, and I still do. So, I would find it almost, disrespectful to change it to my own words, if not really necessary, and I think the dialogues are perfect. So, thank you so much, and enjoy the rest of the festival, unless there are questions.
Well, am I on? Follow that again. I can report, apropos the porridge party, by the way, that the King's Arms on the High Street in Berkhamsted seems not to offer porridge at breakfast time. We have tried for 3 days consecutively to ask for porridge. I don't know whether there's a sort of echo of Dr. Fisher among the kitchen staff at the King's Arms, but if you ask for porridge, perhaps some of you, if you're staying at the Pennyfarthing and going to the King's Arms, or staying at the King's Arms, or just drifting in off the High Street, you might try this tomorrow morning. Go in and ask the staff, have you got porridge? They won't say to you, no, we don't have porridge. That's it. Haven't you read the menu? It doesn't mention porridge. Why are you asking for porridge? You know, the kind of reaction you get from certain sorts of people. No, they don't say that. What they say is, oh, yes, I think we've got some porridge. I'll go and check. And then they go away and check, and a minute later they come back, and 3 days in a row, the answer is, oh, no, we've no oats today, so would you like some Weetabix? I did read, sorry, I'm going on a little bit, Maria, but I'm rising to the challenge now. I did read that that sort of technique of customer service, where you don't say no, you don't turn somebody away, you go and check and then come back and turn them away, but you've met them halfway, and so that's what you'll get at the King's Arms. You are alerted. Now, I think there's a bit of Dr. Fisher behind the catering at the King's Arms in that respect. Maybe they just think you'll expect cold porridge there. But enough. Are there any questions for Maria or comments?
Thank you, Maria. That was great. I just wonder some of the themes of Graham Greene. We talk about Greenland, you know, this place that isn't historical reality. I wonder if some of that could appeal in Germany when you've got so many people who are descended from people who lived in Memel, Konigsberg, Danzig, places which no longer exist. You know, and whether that dislocation could appeal to the German people in that, you know, you're talking about places that no longer exist and so on, whether that would come through in the work.
I don't actually don't know how to answer this. well, if I understand you correctly, you are asking whether there are places in Germany that would compare to Greenland. Oh, yeah, that is true. I don't know if you can compare, because, I mean, Greenland somehow is a rich place, right? And if you have lost space, lost past, lost territory, nothing you like to remember or to memorize, that's rather empty. So, yeah, I don't think you can compare. But there might be a longing in German soul and character and personage for such places, indeed. But it's interesting because I didn't meet many people who reacted too passionate about even the adaptations I tried to offer to theaters. They were thinking, yeah, we don't know, it's not so recent, it dates back in time. And I said, yes, maybe, but I mean, what it is about doesn't matter when it takes place. It's a very general topic that applies to any time because it's in us, no matter what period of time and no matter what territory, I think. Yeah.
Other questions? Wait a second.
All about Berkhamsted. Dr. Fisher, James Mason owned a house in Berkhamsted.
Oh, which one?
Pardon?
Which house?
Rose Cottage, Bank Mill Lane.
So we should go and visit. I should. Totally.
Can I just point out that James Mason may have had a cottage in Berkhamsted, but he's a Yorkshire lad. He was born in... he was born in Huddersfield, Bill. It didn't sound like he's from Huddersfield. I sound rather more like I'm from Huddersfield. But yes, he's a tyke, actually. I didn't know about him being Berkhamsted. Thanks very much for that.
Yes, and James Mason is buried in the next door cemetery from Graham Greene. He's buried in Corsier and Graham Greene in Corso.
You know the reference to James Mason. You've seen the film
where
he plays.
I do.
Sorry,
I do. Yeah.
That's fine. Other questions? Can I ask you? What in particular appealed to you about Dr. Fisher of Geneva as something that would be worth translating, worth staging?
The characters in Dr. Fisher are so well drawn and in such an exaggerated way, and they are so different that I think they are very tempting to play and to act. So that's the first thing I thought. Second is, the story is very topical. I mean, that greed to such an extent that you would even risk your life for it is something that nowadays, when we're discussing the extreme rich confronting the extreme poor, is one of the most topical things of our time. So I found it very touching as well, how a character like Dr. Fisher That also, how a character like Dr. Fisher at the end becomes more of a human being than we think in the beginning. And all this mix was basically the reason why I chose this. After I first chose Our Man in Havana, and which I also thought quite topical, because in times of fake news, the Our Man in Havana story is just the story of our times, but it was difficult to make people understand this. I get the impression more and more theater people are just lacking fantasy, unfortunately. That's my personal impression, at least in Germany. Yeah.
And can I just check? I know we had a show of hands earlier when in William Boyd's session. How many people have read Dr. Fisher of Geneva? Just a matter of interest. I wasn't at the front to see everybody. Have we got more hands up for Dr. Fisher than we did for The Captain and the Enemy? Maybe, I reckon it's about half of the people there. Well, perhaps for those of you who haven't read Dr. Fisher, I ought to point out the, it isn't an irony, is it? The sort of what's just happened. Two of the people who were in that little playlet are, of course, Andrew and Jonathan. And in case you don't know the story is that Dr. Fisher of Geneva first came into Graham Greene's mind at a Christmas dinner in 1978 when he had he'd come up for Christmas to Caroline's Christmas table, Christmas dinner table, and the pulling of Christmas crackers with these young folk as they... I know they're still young, but as they then were, even more than now, gave him the idea. So there's rather a nice circle there that we've ended up with you two playing the parts. Have you two, I'm slightly anticipating tomorrow's interview that we're going to have with you two. Have either of you any memories of that Christmas cracker pulling that ended up in what we've just seen? You're nodding, Jonathan.
Indeed, very good memories of that specific dinner, because it became, so important in the folklore of the family. And it was about, you know how my mother would travel to England very often, and there's one thing she would bring back, apart from the vodka and the sausages, was usually Christmas crackers, because you don't find Christmas crackers in Switzerland. It is not part of the Christmas tradition. Now, unfortunately, as time went by, the industrial might of China took everything over because cheap, and crackers became increasingly, if that's the word, increasingly disappointing. And that one evening, we were pulling crackers, and I think that,
you know, maybe half of the crackers didn't even give out a bang. And whatever came out of it was a badly injection molded piece of plastic something. And so we started this conversation about, well, back in the day, you know, us from our 14-year-old, back in the day, things were better and we would get really interesting toys in the crackers and there was a bigger bang. Well, the bigger the bang, the more interesting the present. And that's how I think it all connected in his mind when we made comments such as, well, if it's a diamond ring in there, it'll blow your hand off. And I think that's really what kind of brought this idea of the final scene of Dr. Fisher, where everybody is asked to root into the barrel to pull out a cracker, one of which contains a bomb.
Or might.
Yes, my mother, following these disappointments, decided to make her own crackers afterwards, and she would buy the components, the kit you can buy with the thing that you pull that makes a bang, and she would keep the toilet roll centers during the year and would put in her own little toys inside. But I remember Graham coming down Christmas morning and saying that he's got an idea for a book. Yeah. Then didn't hear anything of it. And then suddenly at the end of the year, my mother said, Graham is coming out with a book. Out of the blue.
So the I've got an idea for a book preceded the pulling of the Christmas crackers, or it followed it? So that it's definitely that sparked off the idea.
Yes, we had a tradition of having Christmas dinner the eve of Christmas. And Christmas morning, we would have breakfast, and then we would open the presents after breakfast. And so it was in the next morning that he told me that he had an idea. Without saying anything much more.
Sorry, I'm diverted from you, Maria. Were you aware when you cast these two that you were kind of completing a circle?
Well, yes, of course. I was very well aware of that. Yes, of course.
Yeah.
And I'm very glad they joined in.
Other questions, Ross?
I believe there was a story about Graham checking up on the spelling of Fisher to make sure there weren't any Fishers in Geneva. Is that right?
Sorry.
Yeah, that was probably after Graham returned to, I believe he was in Antibes then, calls up my mother and asks her to rummage through the phone books to check there is no Dr. Fisher. Because, you know, he had all sorts of problems with other character names in the past, so wanted to make sure there was no libel or anything like that lurking under that name. So, yeah, indeed. And she spent the best part of a day going through the telephone books of the whole region. So, yeah.
Any other questions? Do I see a hand going up, Hazel?
Thank you so much, Maria. We've had fun with your company.
Thank you.
And I just wondered, you seem to have a real mission about this. And
yes.
I'm wondering how long your energy and stamina will survive in being able to convince the German theatre world.
Well, so far I have been a little bit successful already with that theatre in Bruchsal, wherever that is, playing it. And I know they're traveling with the play as well in the region, so there are some more theatres going to see it, and some more tiny southern German cities. And I have a lot of energy. I'm not giving up so quickly.
Another question, Dermot.
If ever you were looking for a companion piece to perform with your play, have you ever thought of Friedrich Dürrenmatt's play The Visit, which in German is rendered as The Visit of the Old Lady, Dürrenmatt obviously being a Swiss-German playwright, and writing in 1956?
I actually never thought about that, but I mean, I love that play. We had to read it at school. Every German kid knows it, but I can't see any relation here. Or did I misunderstand your question?
He's going to tell you.
The connection would be the corruption by money.
That you mean?
And presents.
Yeah, actually, that's true. But I never thought about it. Maybe because it was at school that I read it last, so it's just too long. It's just been too long ago.
Okay.
Thank you. I just wondered how you expect the German audience to respond to the send-up of the British Secret Service in Amman and Havana. How do you think that will go down?
Well, I don't know. I mean, they'll have to deal with it, I suppose.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I think that's probably the end of our questions. Can I, on behalf of all of you, thank Maria and that cast that was pulled together for the first time. What day are we? Is it Saturday now? Thursday, wasn't it? You first met and had a rehearsal on Thursday, and then this lunchtime, giving up your lunch, as Maria said. Thanks to Maria and to all the cast for such a very different presentation. Thank you very much.